onto the experience and repeat it more easily the next time. Labeling. Another type of language you'll want to pay attention to is how you're labeling yourself and others. There's a ton of research showing how labels can limit your experience. When we put a label on something, we create a corresponding emotion based on our beliefs or experiences. That's especially true when we label ourselves and say that we're depressed or that we're alcoholics. It's true we might be suffering, but by labeling ourselves that we are those things, we ingrain the negative feelings and end up believing them subconsciously. It might take a little while to start catching yourself focusing on the negative or unnecessarily labeling yourself, so keep at it. If you catch yourself once a day, that's a great start. Over time, you'll get better and better at it, and you'll develop ways to reprogram your language to be more positive naturally. Don't be surprised if people start noticing and telling you how much happier and upbeat you seem. That's because you are happier and upbeat when you expect to be, and you will use language to reinforce that idea. The power of positive. Staying positive is one amazing tool you can use to stay alcohol-free for the next few weeks and beyond if you choose. Positive thinking and believing in yourself are helpful, but I'm also talking about the words you use in sentences. Psychologists have studied how our brains process negative statements and found that the way a sentence is constructed actually affects brain activity. Negative construction can cause higher levels of activity, which means we have to think harder. So let's keep this easy, okay? If we don't have to think hard about drinking, the experiment will be less stressful. So say somebody asks you, "Would you like a drink?" You could answer in the negative, "No thanks, I'm not drinking tonight." Or you could answer in the positive, "Yes, I'd love a club soda with lime." By speaking with positive statements, your subconscious mind isn't triggered into activity. It's happy. It believes you enjoy drinking, and so you're enjoying a drink. It just happens to be a non-alcoholic drink this time. And how we talk changes our experiences. According to Albert Ellis, one of the fathers of modern psychology, how we talk about what is happening to us and around us actually changes our emotions around our experiences. One of the most powerful things I want you to learn in this experiment is that you are much more in control of your life than you may realize. Sure, it takes practice and awareness to begin to shape our emotions and our experiences through our language, specifically the language we use when speaking to ourselves. But wow, is it worth it? I honestly can't believe the changes that have happened inside me once I learned the importance of how I talk to myself, the words I use, and even the tone. So do yourself a favor. Over the next few days, start to pay attention to how you speak to yourself. Ask yourself if you would speak to a stranger like that. What about someone you consider a friend? What about your child? I want to talk about listening to your inner voice. You may find it hard to hear your inner voice. And if that's the case, do this. Notice your emotions. When you start to feel anxious, upset, or stressed, or any other negative emotion, use it as a signal to pause and reflect on what you were just saying to yourself. How we speak to ourselves has a huge impact on our emotions. This is not only true around drinking, but in all areas of our lives. Studies show that the majority of most people's thinking is negative and self-destructive. However, since our inner dialogue is constant, we're not often aware of it. The next time you start to feel badly about yourself, I want you to stop and notice the words you just said inside your head. Write them down and then ask yourself, was it nice? Was it helpful? Again, was it something you would say to someone you love, or even something you would say to a complete stranger? Or are you talking to yourself in a more destructive way than you would talk to a total stranger? Take time every day to listen to this inner dialogue and consciously try to speak to yourself with respect. Like any habit, how you speak to yourself is unconscious, and it will take some conscious awareness to discover exactly what that inner dialogue consists of. But you can learn to speak to yourself as you would speak to someone you love, and when you do, your entire life can change for the better. Today, I want you to observe your language patterns. both what you say out loud and the self-talk in your head. And we'll get into even more detail about self-talk later in this book. And write down the words you're using on a piece of paper. Do you use the same words over and over? Are they negative or positive? And when you think about alcohol, do you feel sorry for yourself and tell yourself you're not able to drink? Or do you feel excited about the challenge and tell yourself how you don't have to drink? You don't have to wake up with another hangover. And how are you treating yourself internally? Are the things you're saying to yourself generally helpful or hurtful? Will they make these 30 days a more pleasant experience? Don't judge yourself for using negative language. Instead, think of some ways you can turn your language around and make it more positive. Make it a fun exercise. Day 2 journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Language patterns. Observe your language patterns, both what you say out loud and the self-talk in your head. Write down the words you're using with yourself. Extra credit. Carry a piece of paper or maybe the notes app on your phone with you and notice every time you start to feel upset during the day. Stop and notice what you just said to yourself in your head. Jot those things down. Then ask yourself, would you say that in that tone to someone you love? Would you even say that to a stranger? 2. Change your words, change your experience. Do you believe that how you talk, especially to yourself, can actually change your experiences? Anchor this in by writing down a time that this has happened, and notice how powerful this can be. 3. Choose better words. Make a list of all the things you can say to yourself and others over the next 28 days that will influence how this experiment feels for you. Note, these actually must be things you believe. Otherwise, you risk increasing the cognitive dissonance that's already in your mind. Day 2 reflections from alcoholexperiment.com. Carl says, my mindset has definitely changed. Everyone around me is still drinking and waking up with a hangover. This morning when I woke up and found myself wondering, why would they do that to themselves? Why? Then I remembered, oh yeah, I used to do that to myself too. It was so strange, truly, to not be able to comprehend why people would purposely ingest the poison, knowing that they would wake up feeling like shit. Arletta says, I'm feeling great without alcohol. New things have opened up for me. Some simple things like planting a little garden or trying a new grocery store and exercising more. I've already lost weight. I never have to worry about how much I'll embarrass myself while drinking. I feel more present with my children, and I'm not forgetting as much or having to constantly remind myself of things I said I'd do with them. And Morgan says, already I feel a change happening inside me, and I feel confident in myself again, or maybe for the first time. I feel like there's hope for the future and that there is so much to learn and new ways which I can grow and simply experience being human. Day 3. Why we think we like to drink. Karen Salmonson says, true happiness comes from gaining insight and growing into your best possible self. Otherwise, all you're having is immediate gratification pleasure, which is fleeting and doesn't grow you as a person. Clearly, we must like drinking. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it, right? At least in the beginning, we liked it. Right now, you might be struggling with how much you actually hate the after effects, but there's no denying that that first drink feels good. Before we can unpack all the complicated pieces of the alcohol puzzle, it's important to understand what's happening inside the brain when we drink. So I'm out with my friends and I order a glass of wine. I've had a hard day at work and I'm looking forward to relaxing and laughing with people I love. That first glass makes me feel giggly, and there's a little rush of euphoria that makes me feel good, maybe for the first time all day. What's happening is that the wine is artificially stimulating the area of my brain called the nucleus accumbens, or the pleasure center. The chemicals responsible for euphoria are endorphins, the same chemicals responsible for the good feelings when you exercise. Dopamine and serotonin. Two main chemicals work in the pleasure center. Dopamine, which is responsible for desire and craving, and serotonin, which is responsible for the feelings of satiety or inhibition. In a healthy brain, there's a delicate balance between the two. But alcohol throws that off balance. So as I'm drinking that glass of wine, lots of dopamine gets dumped into my system, making me want more of what gave me pleasure, more alcohol. But since my pleasure center has been artificially stimulated by an outside substance, my brain seeks to regain the correct balance. So it sends out a chemical downer called dynorphin. This actually suppresses my feelings of euphoria. And as the effects of the first glass start to wear off, my sense of well-being actually falls below where it was when I started drinking. This means I'm lower than when I got off work after a hard day. Bummer. The dopamine is still working, though, and makes me crave more of what makes me feel good. So I order another glass of wine, and the cycle starts all over again. An unwanted effect is that in order to combat the depressant effects of alcohol, my body counteracts the alcohol by releasing things like adrenaline and cortisol. You've probably heard of cortisol. It's also known as the stress hormone. So now in my body's attempt to maintain homeostasis and combat the alcohol, I'm lower than when I started. In other words, I now have to cross an even bigger gap to get above that baseline of pleasure. And that's miserable. And even worse, though, is that the alcohol is starting to affect other areas of my brain. My senses are being numbed. My brain is actually slowing down. Eventually, I might slur my speech. Perhaps my vision blurs. I feel detached from reality. And I convince myself that this is a welcome break from the real world. The cycle continues, and I get more and more drunk. What was at first a nice tipsy feeling is now completely out of control. But I don't care because my brain isn't processing the long-term meanings and implications of my behavior. Eventually, if I'm drinking a lot, it's been slowed down so much that I have to work hard just to walk straight on my way to the restroom. My brain receptors have become numb, and my senses don't relay the information as well, so memories aren't formed. I don't completely recall the embarrassing things I say or do while I'm drunk. I don't feel the pain I'm trying to escape. The stress from the workday fades away after a little while, but the stress remains when I sober up and is now compounded by the hangover I'm suffering from. The embarrassing photos that show up on Facebook and my best friend who won't talk to me because I pissed her off so badly, somehow, but I'm not really sure what happened. If you're reading this book, you probably know what I'm talking about. That initial rush doesn't last. And the more drunk you get, the more you regret it when you sober up. It's a downward spiral. And if you're like me, you blame yourself. Why can't I get it together? Why am I so weak? What's wrong with me? Today, I want you to realize that the cycle has nothing to do with you being strong or weak. It has nothing to do with you being a good or a bad person. It is a chemical chain reaction that happens to everyone. And although we all feel the effects slightly differently based on our age, weight, sex, and environment, the biological reactions are the same. Day 3, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Brain chemicals. Reflect on the teaching about what is happening inside your brain. Just write what comes to mind. How does this make you feel? What was the most surprising thing about today's lesson? How can you use this knowledge going forward? 2. It's not your fault. Can you begin to see that your brain, in relation to an addictive substance, has actually been doing exactly what it's supposed to do? Feel that. You've truly been doing the best you can with the tools you have. Alcohol just might not be the best tool, at least not all the time. How does it feel to know that there's nothing wrong with you? Reflect on the knowledge that you are whole, not broken, despite what you may have believed. How does that make you feel? Day 3 Reflections from thealcoholexperiment.com. Monica says, "This is my third day and already I feel like I slept better. I woke up happy that I finally committed myself mentally. It's a shift I've had a hard time explaining or putting my finger on. I'm embracing the idea that I do not need to hit rock bottom. It's hard to break away from that way of thinking, but I believe in my heart now that this is true. I can quit right now, feel better right now, and just not drink again. It's that simple. A true aha moment." Brady says, "I had a situation last night that would typically send me straight to the bottle or a six-pack of beer, and I won." And Penny says, "This is the first Saturday in as long as I can remember when I haven't woken up hungover and miserable. I'm anxious, which feels like a craving, but I recognize that it's because I have so much time on my hands. What shall I do? I'm going to need to get some hobbies." Act 2. Alcohol and sleep. Awareness. When I started researching this book, I sent out a survey asking people what their biggest fears were about giving up alcohol. And I was surprised to see sleep come up high on the list. It's a huge fear for people that they won't be able to fall asleep or they won't be able to stay asleep without drinking. So let's name this belief. I need alcohol to sleep. If you're struggling with this belief, you're definitely not alone. One of my favorite authors, William Porter, who wrote Alcohol Explained, is well-versed in alcohol's effect on sleep, and he explains this topic brilliantly. So let's dig into this belief a bit deeper. Clarity. I'm not sure how much the media is responsible for this particular belief. There's not a lot of insomnia portrayed in the movies or TV. However, if you've ever had a bout of sleeplessness, you know how disconcerting it can be. Sleep is critical to our mental and physical well-being, and when you can't sleep, you'll do anything to be able to fall asleep. Lack of sleep has been linked to serious health problems, including cancer, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, infections, and obesity. It also affects alertness, mood, and physical strength. This is because your body repairs itself while you sleep. Sleep is also a time when your mind digests what's happened during the day. It assimilates the information and often comes up with solutions to problems. So when you wake up, you feel better physically and mentally. That means if you've experienced alcohol helping you sleep, then this belief takes hold very quickly. Regular, high-quality sleep is essential to our well-being. So let's look at how sleep actually works. There are two levels of sleep: rapid eye movement, REM sleep, and deep sleep, or slow wave sleep. Every night, you go through several cycles of both levels. First, you dip into REM sleep, when you're a bit restless and your eyes are literally darting back and forth inside your eyelids, which is where the name comes from. This is light sleep, but it's crucial to good health. Scientists don't actually know why REM sleep is so important, but they've done studies where rats were deprived of REM sleep and it killed them in just a few weeks. Once you cycle out of REM, you go into a deeper level of slow wave sleep. That's when the body does the repair work that needs to happen to keep you healthy. And when you're getting a good night's sleep, you go through 6 or 7 cycles of both REM and deep sleep. Now, what happens when alcohol is introduced into the equation? Alcohol is a chemical depressant, so it actually reduces neural activity in the brain. Normally, your brain releases a variety of chemicals and hormones at different times to help bring you back into balance or homeostasis. As you already know, homeostasis is that delicate balance where all the systems in your body are working correctly. When you drink, you're introducing a foreign chemical. And in order to reach homeostasis, your brain has to release powerful counter chemicals and stress hormones. So the cycle looks like this. You have a drink and you stimulate your pleasure center while the blood alcohol is rising. But as time goes on and the alcohol levels start to go down, your brain knows that there's a depressant in your system. So it releases stimulants, adrenaline and cortisol, to bring you back up into homeostasis. Unfortunately, the depressant alcohol wears off before the stimulants do, and you're left with an overstimulated brain a few hours after the drinks have worn off. It's as if you drank alcohol and a triple espresso at the same time. The alcohol wears off, but the espresso is still affecting you hours later. The alcohol is disrupting your sleep schedule. After you drink, you go into a deep sleep for the first 4 or 5 hours. This might seem great, but during this time, you don't get into REM sleep. And of course, you need both. So while your body is trying to process all the chemicals, your cycles are completely thrown out of whack. You wind up with only 1 or 2 cycles of REM sleep instead of the 6 or 7 you actually need. Now, after those first 5 hours, you wake up and you can't easily get back to sleep. Many people wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning and fret about everything they can think of. The worry and regret creep in, and negative thoughts take over the brain. All this is happening because you're overstimulated and your body chemistry is completely out of balance. Here's the thing. Any amount of alcohol will disrupt your sleep. It doesn't matter if you have one drink or you go on to a margarita binge fest. You're just not going to sleep well. And if you do this night after night, the lack of quality sleep cycles will begin to take their toll. And there's another big problem. When you start to get ready for bed without alcohol in your system, your body naturally releases its own chemicals to quiet you down and prepare you for sleep. But when you drink regularly, you train your brain to utilize the artificial depressants in alcohol to do that job for it. So that means you're relying on alcohol to put you to sleep, but you still aren't rested because your natural sleep rhythms are out of whack. So what does this mean for you during this experiment? It means that for the first 2 to 5 nights of not drinking, your body may still be expecting those artificial depressants. Your brain might be confused during those early days and you could have trouble falling asleep. But the worst thing you can do at that point is to have a drink to help you sleep. It might seem like the right thing to do, but it will actually set your progress back. The good news is that most people find they're sleeping better than ever after the 5th night. You've given your brain time to readjust itself and to get the chemical release balanced again. And once this happens, for the first time in possibly years or maybe decades, you will start getting the rest that your body so desperately needs, and this is great news. While you're waiting for your brain to readjust, you can try a few tricks to help you get to sleep. First, avoid caffeinated drinks after about noon. Caffeine can affect the body for up to 10 hours, so you want it all out of your system by the time you're ready to hit the sack. The other trick is to get some exercise. When you get your body moving, you actually find you sleep much better than if you're at rest all day long. And you don't have to do anything extreme. You can simply take a walk in the fresh air or just get your blood moving. If you've been drinking for a long time, you may not even notice the daily fatigue you're experiencing because of disrupted sleep patterns. You might just think it's because you're getting older. Maybe you're always tired and you're telling yourself, that's just how it is. We are so overworked and undernourished that fatigue has become completely normal. So let me give you some great news. Once you stop drinking and get your sleep regulated, that fatigue and brain fog often disappears completely. You'll feel better than you have in ages, and that's your reward. But you have to get through those first few days and give your body a chance to fix and heal itself. Turnaround. The opposite of I need alcohol to sleep is I don't need alcohol to sleep. Now come up with as many ways as you can that the opposite is as true or truer than your original belief. Day 4, dealing with discomfort. Sydney Banks said, if the only thing that people learned was not to be afraid of their experience, that alone would change the world. When you decide to give up alcohol, you might experience some discomfort. Now, I'm not talking about severe physical addiction here. If you've been drinking heavily for a long time, your body and mind may have become physically dependent to the point where you have severe withdrawal symptoms, such as delirium tremens or hallucinations. If that's the case, you need to get medical help. You may even need to be hospitalized for a while. When I say discomfort, I'm talking about the physical symptoms that occur while your body is healing itself. I'm also talking about the psychological and emotional discomfort that comes up because you're giving up something you believe you need. It takes time, up to a week or longer, for your body to rebalance after you stop drinking. While that's happening, you're probably going to feel uncomfortable because alcohol is physically addictive. There are withdrawal symptoms, which are different for different people. When I stopped drinking, I had headaches, anxiety, irritability, and weird nightmares that I accidentally had a drink. The first 10 days were the most intense, but the symptoms went on to some degree for about 30 days. Clearly, that's longer than the time it took for the chemical substance to clear out of my body. So what gives? Why did it take so long? Shouldn't we feel better as soon as the alcohol is gone? But our bodies are more complicated than that, and there's an emotional side to withdrawal as well. When researchers studied heroin addicts, they found that the severity of withdrawal could depend on the individual's access to the substance they were addicted to. For instance, if the person went to jail and suddenly had zero access to their drug of choice, the withdrawal symptoms weren't as severe as one might expect. But when that person was released even years later and suddenly had access again, the withdrawal symptoms came back. How weird is that? How is it possible to go through withdrawal years after ingesting a substance? This demonstrates how physical and emotional withdrawals are totally intertwined. Each affects the other, and our subconscious can easily keep things buried for a long time and then allow them to resurface later. Changing your mindset. What helped me get through this initial period of physical withdrawals was flipping my mindset. Instead of seeing the headaches and anxiety as punishment for an addiction that I should have been able to control, I chose to see them as signs that my amazing body was healing itself. I knew I had been treating it poorly, so I decided to treat it with kindness and give it whatever time it needed to heal. If you're not feeling your best right now, cut yourself some slack. Imagine if your child was feeling sick. Would you yell at her for being a bad person or tell her she was getting what she deserved? Of course not. You'd let her rest on the couch, eat chicken soup, and maybe watch some cartoons. You'd tell her to let her body do its job. Please give yourself the same courtesy. The emotional aspects. As we've discussed, there's more to withdrawal than the physical discomfort. There's an emotional side as well, and both sides are all tangled up with each other. It's almost like as soon as you get a handle on one, the other falls to pieces and you're tempted to give up this experiment and crack open a beer. I get it. On the emotional side, you might feel sad, angry, or resentful. After all, you're giving up something you believe you enjoy. Your subconscious believes you need alcohol to loosen up, relax, have fun with your friends, or handle stress. When you take that coping mechanism away, without dealing with these subconscious beliefs, there will be consequences in the form of emotional distress and cravings. That's why I'm calling these 30 days an experiment. You're simply testing the waters to see how you might feel if you weren't drinking. Your subconscious mind isn't necessarily going to like that, but it's better than laying down the law and saying no more alcohol ever. That kind of ultimatum can result in a full-on emotional mutiny. Through the course of this experiment, you're going to explore these subconscious beliefs of yours. One day at a time, we're going to cover different ideas that may make you question what you once thought was true. And by the time you reach the end of this book, in fact, you might decide that you never need or want another drink. And your subconscious will totally go along with it. That's actually called spontaneous sobriety, and it happens all the time. It happened to me. When your conscious and subconscious minds are in harmony and desire the same thing, there's no cognitive dissonance. And when that happens, there's no struggle. You have no cravings and no desire to go back. Getting curious. But that's later. So for right now, simply realize that your feelings and the physical symptoms are real. Take the time to feel them, honor them, appreciate what your body's trying to tell you, and do not give in to the temptation to use alcohol to numb them. These symptoms are all temporary. They will go away in time. So what can you do in the meantime? How do you handle the emotional discomfort and the strong desire to give in? My solution was to get curious about my own behavior. anytime I had a strong urge to drink, I sat with it and went deeper into what was going on. I became an internal reporter. I asked myself questions all the time to find out what I was feeling exactly and what was actually causing me to feel that way. Sometimes I felt like I was missing out because I was with a group of friends who were all drinking. Other times, I'd had a hard day at work and felt like I needed a drink to calm my nerves. Other times, I felt like I'd been good for so long that I just deserved to have a drink as a reward. So today, instead of trying to ignore or overcome your discomfort by having a drink, ask yourself, why do I want a drink right now? What is it that I think alcohol will do to make this moment better? And then ask yourself, is that true? If you're completely objective and honest, you might actually surprise yourself with your answers. Do this little exercise first. Write down your answers or record yourself in a video diary or voice memo. By doing this, you're observing the symptoms as something separate from you. You're giving yourself perspective and a little bit of time for the feelings to subside. And remember that your body is amazing. It's taking care of you right now by getting rid of all the toxins that it's had to deal with for a long time. Yes, you might not feel your best for a bit, but when the process is complete, your body will feel better than ever. And consider the online social challenge at alcoholexperiment.com. Again, you can find thousands of others who are doing this experiment with you. And sharing insights with others in a safe, judgment-free environment is incredibly powerful. Day 4 journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Discomfort so far. Even the worst feelings fade with time. Today, you can memorialize any discomfort you've experienced to help you become more mindful in the future. Take a minute and write about all the ways you have felt physically uncomfortable these first few days of the experiment. Be as specific as possible. 2. Temptations so far? What specifically has tempted you to drink? What reasons have you given yourself to consider giving in? Become very mindful and outline below both your triggers and your brain's logic as it tries to convince you to drink. Day 4 reflections from alcoholexperiment.com. Robin says, good days but bad nights. Woke up at 3 a.m., not feeling the best but definitely not hungover. And a bit of a headache this morning. I spent the day thinking about all the holiday times with my kids that I don't remember, and yesterday it dawned on me how much time alcohol has stolen from me. And yes, I let it. But the reading today very much reinforced that, and I am generally happy and still thankful. George says, I've been having such strange dreams. I feel such a physical difference. I didn't realize alcohol takes so long to get out of your system. So even though I binge drink once or twice a week, I was feeling so crappy because I was never alcohol-free. I had constant headaches, fatigue, bloating, and nausea. I am learning so much. And Hector says, didn't expect the physical symptoms to be so real. Glad I understand why I'm still having them. Still better than being hungover. Need to be gentle on myself and others through this. Cannot wait to sleep again. Day 5. What are cravings, really? Nana Jane said, knowledge renders belief obsolete. I found there are two kinds of cravings you have to contend with at different times. Physical cravings and emotional cravings. Physical symptoms, such as anxiety, restlessness, and the inability to sleep, show up while the alcohol is still in your system. We know they're cravings because they'll go away if you give in and have a drink. And again, it can take up to a week for alcohol to completely leave your system, so that's about how long you can expect for those physical cravings to last. After that point, you're most likely looking at mental or emotional cravings. Unfortunately, you probably know the exact time you had a drink. When people try to get over a sugar addiction, They sometimes consume sugar without even knowing it because it's hidden in so many food products. But psychological or emotional cravings can be much harder to handle, simply because they're triggered by certain circumstances that your subconscious knows from experience may be helped by having a drink. You've reached the point in your relationship with alcohol that it's taking more than it's giving, and you feel like you want to cut back or stop. That's a conscious decision you've made. But if your subconscious mind still believes that alcohol is the key to relaxation and that you have to have a drink to have a good time with your friends, then those psychological cravings will creep in, sometimes years after you've had any alcohol. Your desires originate from your subconscious mind, and craving is a desire. Cravings and stress. For example, if you used to handle work stress by drinking like I did, then every time you experience work stress, you'll likely trigger a psychological craving for alcohol. You've already wired your brain to do this. It's a learned response. Your subconscious believes drinking reduces stress, even though science has proven that alcohol actually increases stress over time. And even though you've made a conscious decision not to drink, your subconscious hasn't gotten the memo, so it sends up a desire, a craving. If your cravings are triggered by stress, you have to find another way to reduce that stress. Studies have shown over and over that exercise is a great way to do that. Once those endorphins get released, the stress and cravings subside. Mindfulness and meditations are also great ways to reduce stress. And don't worry, you don't have to shave your head and move to Tibet. There are all kinds of forms of meditation. All you're really doing is exercising your brain. The internal battle. So you have this battle going on inside of you. Your conscious and subconscious are fighting it out over whether you want to drink. And it's frustrating. It's confusing. And it's tempting to try and ignore the craving or exert your willpower over it. But that rarely works. Science tells us that the more we try to repress a thought or ignore something, the harder it is to escape that thought. It's much better to be completely present and mindful during a craving. You do this by noticing how you feel and what thoughts are running through your head when you separate yourself. You become an observer, watching this weird battle between your conscious and subconscious. When you detach yourself from the outcome, you're actually less likely to give in. I like to visualize my subconscious mind as a child riding in the back seat of a car. Suddenly the child decides he or she wants an ice cream and won't let it go. Now children are the best salespeople in the world because they just don't give up. They don't take no for an answer. They'll keep attacking the problem in a different way over and over and over until they get what they want. Can I have an ice cream, Mom? That ice cream sure looks good. Look, Mom, a gas station. Don't you need gas? I bet they have great ice cream inside. What's your favorite ice cream, Mom? I like chocolate. So, when are we going to get the ice cream, now or after dinner? You know what would make Dad happy? A surprise ice cream. If children think there's even the slightest chance that they'll get what they desire, they will keep pestering you. And even if you don't have kids, you've been a kid, so you know what I'm talking about, right? The only way to get children to give up is to get rid of the desire, which means either distracting them or making them understand that there is no way that they're getting an ice cream. Distraction. This is how you can deal with cravings too. You can distract yourself with a book or a walk or a dinner date. You can also substitute something that will satisfy the desire without giving into the craving. If you need to hold a glass in your hand at a networking event, fill it with tonic water or soda. Often that's enough to satisfy your subconscious child. But what if distraction doesn't work and you still have the craving? This means your little darling believes there's a chance you'll give in. And we all know how that works with kids and ice cream, right? If you give in once, the next time they will be even more relentless. It will be even harder to get them to stop nagging you. All the kid cares about is getting the ice cream, and they won't stop until they truly believe that there's no way it's going to happen. Relying on willpower to resist a craving is like arguing with a child using grown-up logic. Sorry, honey, we don't have time to stop for ice cream. It will spoil your dinner. We don't have the money right now. You don't need an ice cream. What kid ever falls for that stuff? They come up with a counter-argument every time. And they'll outlast you. Eventually, they'll wear you down. But here's something cool about your subconscious. It can produce strong desires, but it can't make you take action. It's your conscious mind that decides whether to give in. And you have a choice. The more times you don't give in to your subconscious, the faster it will get the message next time. No means no. Be the parent. When your subconscious understands that you don't go back on your word, then it will believe you when you say, "Not today, honey. Maybe next week we'll have an ice cream, but for today we're going to skip it." A good friend of mine told me about using a key phrase that got her kids to stop nagging. She said she would go into duck mode, which meant that she let whatever the child was saying roll off her back, just like water rolls off a duck's back. When she said duck mode, her kids knew that there was no way that they were getting what they wanted. And this is because she had never once gone into duck mode and then given in. She had taught them that duck mode meant business and that there was simply no point in arguing any longer. And because of her dedication to the tool, her kids truly believed that once she had gone into duck mode, it was in their best interest to just be quiet. They knew there was no longer anything they could say that would make a difference. And so peace was restored. In my analogy of the child in the backseat of a car, the driver, your conscious mind, is in control, and the child, your subconscious mind, believes it. You can come up with a key phrase of your own, whatever works for you. Now today, anytime you start to crave a drink, visualize your craving as an incessant child. And then instead of getting angry or frustrated, use whatever technique gets the child to believe you're serious about your commitment. Distraction or duck mode or whatever works for you is perfect. Day 5, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Describe your cravings. How exactly do your cravings feel? Be really specific. How do you feel physically? How do you feel emotionally? Go into as much detail as possible, and remember not to judge your craving. Just experience and describe it. 2. The stories your cravings tell you. We all have the little kid asking for ice cream inside of us. What does your little kid say to get you to give in to a drink? Some of my stories were, "I'll never feel good again without alcohol." Or, "I won't be able to overcome this, so why even try?" And, "This is too hard, so what's the point?" Now, what are yours? Write down all the stories that come to mind. 3. Are these stories true? Now take a minute to look at what you wrote and ask yourself, are these stories true? And who would you be without these stories? What would life feel like without these stories? Day 5 reflections from alcoholexperiment.com. Tammy says, "Last night my husband had a bottle of wine in the fridge. Told him to go ahead, I didn't want any, and there was no craving, no thoughts of missing out." Trish said, "I'm feeling very accomplished. I went to a Mexican restaurant today, and I did not order a beer or a margarita." What? That's huge for me. Most of my poor drinking habits are triggered in social situations. So this was a small victory for me. I love going to see live music, and there's a concert coming up in less than a month, and the idea of not having a drink there is daunting. I wonder, will I even have fun? OMG, I feel so ridiculous for even thinking this, but it's the truth. I'm no longer going to lie or cover up my thoughts around drinking. I'm just going to keep shining a light on them so eventually they'll have nowhere to hide and there will be nothing left for me to be afraid of." And Peggy says, "I've struggled with my spouse's drinking for years, but realize I have a problem too and I need to focus on myself. I love waking up feeling great. I love not planning around drinking. I feel good about not being part of the problem, which I was drinking with my spouse. Really, how can I preach moderation or quitting when I'm not moderating or quitting?" Day 6. My willpower doesn't work for long. If you don't sacrifice for what you want becomes the sacrifice. Anonymous. For our purposes, we will specifically define willpower as using conscious mental energy or effort to stop doing something like drinking or start doing something like exercise. If you've ever tried to lose weight, stop gambling, or make your bed every day for a month, you've probably tried to harness willpower to get through it. Spending 30 days alcohol-free is no different. It's only 30 days, right? How hard could it be? Well, here's the deal with willpower. It's a finite and exhaustible resource. Willpower can also be defined as the ability to resist short-term temptations in order to meet long-term goals. Some people think it's a skill that can be honed and perfected, or a muscle that can be built up and maintained. But it doesn't seem to work that way. New research shows it's much more like an energy reserve, and when the reserve is low, there's not much you can do until you top it back up. Why willpower fluctuates. Mark Moravin, an associate professor of sociology at Case Western Reserve University, wanted to understand why he had lots of willpower at certain times, but not at others. He conducted an experiment to prove that willpower was more effective when conserved, and when taxed, it could run out. Subjects, under the guise that they were participating in a taste-based experiment, were placed in a room with two bowls on the table. One bowl was full of fresh baked cookies and the other was full of radishes. Half the subjects were told to eat the cookies and ignore the radishes, and half the subjects were told to eat the radishes and ignore the cookies. Bummer for them. After 5 minutes, both groups were given a puzzle. This puzzle appeared easy, but it didn't actually have a solution. Because the puzzle was impossible, continuing to work on it required willpower. And the subjects who had previously used willpower to ignore the cookies worked on the puzzle for 60% less time than the subjects who had not had to use any of their willpower reserves. And there was a drastic difference in attitudes. The radish eaters were grumpy, frustrated, and even snapped at the researchers. All decisions take energy. Every decision you make requires you to expend a certain amount of energy, and that includes energy you might prefer to save up for exercising willpower. If you've had a hard day at work and you have to make lots of decisions, your energy and willpower will both be lower. This is why it's easier to resist temptation early in the day, but by the time 5 o'clock rolls around, you just want a martini. It's exhausting exercising your willpower all day. There's also something called the what the hell effect, which explains what happens when you abandon your quest for willpower, give in to temptation, and then, since you feel badly for giving in, throw caution to the wind and end up going overboard. You slip up and drink. Regret sets in, but since you've already had one drink, you think, what the hell? I might as well get drunk. No matter how much willpower you started the day with, by the time happy hour rolls around, it's pretty much gone. You might be able to muster up willpower for the next evening, but what about when you get home? What about the next day and the next? What are you going to do, lock yourself in a closet for the rest of your life? Clearly, willpower is not the answer as long as your cognitive dissonance around drinking remains firmly embedded in your mind. As long as there are two competing ideas, to drink or not to drink, you'll struggle and expend energy trying to resist those subconscious messages using your conscious logic. But once you resolve that dissonance and are of one mind around alcohol, there is no struggle. There's no decision to make, and willpower is no longer required. Then you can use it for something else, like saying no to that piece of chocolate cake. Of course, you can use the ACT technique and take care of your chocolate cravings, too. But today, I want you to take out a small piece of paper or an index card and write down a few of the facts about alcohol that you now know to be true. Alcohol actually increases stress in the body. When I go out with my friends, I'm actually happy just drinking tonic and lime. I don't need alcohol to have fun. Then keep that card handy in your wallet or cell phone case. Whenever you feel yourself relying on willpower to get through the situation or feel like you're about to give in, pull out the card and read it. Calm the dissonance in your mind and that will do more than trying to grit your way through any situation. Day 6, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Your experience, willpower. When do you have the least amount of willpower? When you're tired, bored, lonely, hungry, angry? These times make it harder for us to handle cravings. And studies show we're more likely to give in these moments. When are these times for you? Be specific. The more specific you are in writing these down, the more aware you'll be when they crop up. 2. Anchor in your learning. Write down some of the things you've learned so far in this experiment. If you had doubts about them, write those down as well. By doing this, you're changing your mindset so that you will no longer have to rely on willpower. Day 6 reflections from alcoholexperiment.com. Carl says, I left work thinking I wanted and needed a drink. My boss has been a total jerk for a few days, and it's not like him to be like that. Anyway, it's very uncomfortable. I was able to resist the drink and ride it out, and I actually feel better. Alcohol does numb my brain, so I quit obsessing about it. I may or may not talk to him about it tomorrow, but not drinking is really my first priority. It changes everything for me. I feel better, I look better, I'm more clear-headed, less anxious, foggy, etc. I could go on and on. Thanks, everybody, and thanks, Annie. Cami says, two things are really going well. Probably more, but these two are delighting me at the moment. 1, I'm waking up with so much more energy and channeling it into all sorts of creative projects. 2, I feel my mood lifting a little more each day, and I was convinced that I'd live the rest of my life under a cloud of depression and grumpiness. I'm welcoming back my silly, quirky, goofy self. I love that version of me. She makes me smile. And God love my husband for hanging around with the cranky, grumpy version for so long. He's smiling more these last few days, too. And James says, for a while now, I've been somewhat grumpy about the cognitive dissonance. I gave up alcohol for a bit after finding more out about booze, but then I started again. The problem was that with my new knowledge about alcohol, I didn't really enjoy drinking. I hated the hangovers and the anxiety that followed. I was even mad that by knowing more about alcohol, my drinking hobby, the thing that connected me with so many people in my life, had been ruined for me. So I kept drinking. But this time is different. All that seems to have gone. There's clear blue sky in my head, not storm clouds. I can confidently say no to a drink. I know there are challenges ahead, but I'm feeling very positive about them. Act 3. Alcohol relaxation and stress relief. Awareness. If you're drinking to relax, like I used to do, you're not alone. Relaxation and stress relief are some of the main reasons people drink. After all, who can deny that a few drinks totally relaxes you and relieves everyday pressures, stress, and anxiety? There's a reason it's called happy hour, right? You can't use willpower to grit your way through and ignore the idea that alcohol relaxes you. So let's name this belief. Alcohol relieves stress and helps me relax. We watch people in movies and on TV and all around us drinking to relax. There's a reason that happy hour starts at 5 o'clock. Work stresses us out. Money stresses us out. Our relationships stress us out. And stress stresses us out. It's a major contributor to many deadly diseases. For most of us, the pressures and expectations of modern living seem out of control. And we're taught to simply drink our problems away instead of facing them head on. Clarity. So why do we believe this? When in our past have we observed and experienced alcohol taking the stress off anxiety? We could start with our parents and relatives. When you were young, did your mom or dad come home after a long day and immediately pour a drink? It's been part of our culture since we were children. And if not yours, what about your friends' parents? We certainly all watch TV shows or movies where the dad comes home and immediately grabs a beer from the fridge. Or the homicide detectives talk over the case at a local bar. As we grew older and went to college, partying was the natural way to blow off the stress from exams or a long day of lectures. We've seen people doing this in real life, and there are numerous movies whose whole storyline revolves around a huge college drunk fest after final exams. It's almost inevitable that we started mimicking what we observed. Everywhere we look, society is telling us that if we have to do something hard, we need a drink to cope with it. So it's pretty easy to see where this belief might have come from. Take a few minutes right now to think about or write down some specific instances where you observed or experienced alcohol being relaxing. If your parents drank after work, what exactly did they drink? And how did they behave afterwards? What specific movies or TV shows do you remember watching where a character drank to relax? Try and pinpoint how and when you started to believe that you needed alcohol to relax. Now, let's look at some internal and external evidence to help you decide whether alcohol truly helps you relax. First of all, let's define true relaxation. What exactly are we trying to do with the stress and anxiety we may be experiencing in the moment? We're trying to get rid of it, right? True relaxation is the absence of stress and anxiety. It's not ignoring the stress or numbing it. Real relaxation removes it completely. To get to that point, though, you must deal with the source of the stress. Talk with your boss about a problem. Rearrange your schedule to avoid a conflict, or whatever it is you need to do to remove the source of the discomfort. You can't get that out of a bottle. A shot of tequila cannot fix your marriage. It can only make you not worry about it for a little while. It's true that you can equate the initial tipsy feeling with being relaxed. But how long can you sustain it? 20 minutes? An hour? Drinkers almost never feel relaxed for a full hour because the alcohol is metabolized, and we actually feel more stressed than we did when we started drinking. Alcohol leaving the body makes us feel worse. So what do? We have another drink. It's ironic that we drink to relax because drinking actually adds stress to our lives. I'm not going to deny that alcohol definitely provides the illusion of relaxation, especially at first. But here's what's actually happening. The drink is simply numbing the senses and slowing the mind. For a short time, we truly don't care about our problems, and we feel relaxed. But we're not actually eliminating the problem or concern. Instead of solving the issue and removing it, we're just postponing it and prolonging the pain. But because we build a tolerance for alcohol, we need more and more of it to have the same effect, which introduces a host of other stress-inducing concerns. How much did I drink last night? Why is my wife angry with me? What embarrassing things did I do or say? How am I going to get up and go to work with this hangover? How can my bank account be overdrawn again? This cycle is the opposite of relaxation. It puts additional stress and strain on our health, finances, and relationships. And the more we use alcohol to numb our senses, and the more alcohol we need, the more stress we add to our lives. After a few years of regular drinking, the stress can truly become unbearable. Think about it like this. If alcohol relaxed us, wouldn't we need less of it over time? So why do we find we need more and more of it to reach that same level of, quote, relaxation? If we drink to relax on a daily basis, shouldn't it be easier, not harder, to get that relief? Let's also take a look at the external evidence around this belief and what's actually happening neurologically when you drink. Your brain is a reactive mechanism. When you drink, it reacts to bring your body back into balance. Because alcohol is a natural depressant, your brain counteracts it by releasing stimulants, again, including adrenaline and cortisol. And guess what? Those are not only stimulants, but also stress hormones. Cortisol is released in stressful situations and has been linked to a higher risk of infection, mood swings, high blood pressure, fat storage, and even premature aging. Talk about added stress. And adrenaline is linked to your fight or flight response, which is great if you're being chased by a lion, But in large amounts, adrenaline is also linked to insomnia, nervousness, and lower levels of immunity. And here's where the bad news gets worse. Remember that alcohol takes about a week to completely leave your body. So if you're a regular drinker, you are in a constant state of alcohol withdrawal, which means you have consistently elevated levels of cortisol and adrenaline, which means you're always stressed out on a physiological level. Add on the everyday stressors of work, health, and relationships, and it's no wonder you want to escape for a little while. One drink and that anesthetic takes over, decreasing your senses and slowing your brain function. And the more you drink, the less you feel. And if you drink until you pass out, you get to feel absolutely nothing for a short time. But guess what? As soon as you sober up, all those stressors will remain, and then some, because we've made things worse. And the longer you drink to relax, the more the problems will pile up, and you'll become less and less capable of handling everyday complications. Scientists studied this phenomenon with two groups of mice. One group was given alcohol over a 30-day period, and the other was not. At the end of the 30 days, they were put through extraordinarily stressful situations, and their responses were measured. The mice that had consumed alcohol had a much harder time dealing with all the external stressors presented to them. This was the same for me. When I was drinking regularly, even the most mundane problems overwhelmed me completely. But once alcohol was no longer affecting my internal systems, I'm able to handle them without a problem. Now, I know life isn't always easy, but when you drink, you're limiting your ability to cope, and so everything you do feels so much more difficult. So now what do you think? Does alcohol really relax you? Does it actually help you deal with stress and anxiety? Or is it simply numbing you out so you can ignore it for a little while? Understanding the root cause of your stress and removing it completely is the only way to enjoy true relaxation. Turnaround. The opposite of alcohol relieves stress and helps me relax is alcohol does not relieve stress and help me relax, or alcohol adds stress to my life. Come up with as many ways as you can that the opposite is as true or truer than the original belief. Day 7. Your experiment and your friends. Mark Twain said, "Whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to reform or to pause and reflect." You've been working on this experiment for about a week now. Congratulations. How do you feel? Are people starting to notice? At this point, some of your friends might be noticing that something about you has changed. Maybe you've been out with them and turned down a drink. Or maybe they've noticed a change in your behavior or even in your physical appearance. Sooner or later, you're going to have to tell somebody about what you're doing. And sometimes your friends won't understand why you've decided to spend 30 days alcohol-free. Not only that, but they may even keep offering you drinks right through the challenge. They may say, "Come on, it's just one, don't be such a loser." When people want to quit smoking, everyone around them is supportive and thinks it's great. And a friend wouldn't even think of offering a cigarette to another friend in that situation. So what makes